This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Hey everyone, I'm Jessica from the Leaving the Village podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you for tuning into this show. We're so grateful that you've decided to spend your time with us. Seriously, Dan, Gail, Kathleen, Nate, Scott, and the rest of us here at the Dauntless Media Collective couldn't produce content like the show you're listening to without your support. I'd also like to invite you even further into the conversation. Right now, there are some great discussions happening over in the Dauntless Media Collective Discord server. If you're interested in chatting with other folks who are deconstructing and decolonizing the oppressive traditions they came from, please feel free to hop onto the server. If you don't know what Discord is, it's a place where communities can gather online for chatting on a wide variety of topics. In our Discord server, we have channels devoted to general deconstruction conversations, some meme sharing, therapeutic venting about whatever religious bullshit you're currently dealing with, and even a channel specifically devoted to talking about the latest episode of the podcast you're listening to right now. I hope you'll join us. You can log in directly to the Dauntless server by clicking on the link in the show notes or heading to dauntless.fm and clicking on the link in the top banner. See you there.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter.
It's another episode of the Thereafter podcast. Your hosts here, Cortland and Megan. Megan,
hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I just got back from a little vacay in New York City.
The Big Apple.
Yeah, it's a little bit busy for me. And expensive. Like, what?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got to see Ani DiFranco in a Broadway show, which... comes around full circle. I got to have a meal with Janice Pagata. That was incredible. So
love her.
Yeah. It's nice to go to New York maybe once every 10 years.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want to get out there. Last time I was in New York, I was there for like 48 hours and it was for work. And I had texted Janice and it was like, we're going to hang out. And she like made time for me. And then I ended up like not being able to. And I felt terrible.
Yeah,
and
she then said she gave that me mad shit about she didn't it. Make your list. I think those were her words.
She gave me mad shit about it when I saw her at Content Warning. So next time I'm in NYC, we're going to hang for sure.
Yeah, no, but I will say I lived in Chicago for a while. I did the whole city thing, and I just don't know if I have it in me. I saw somebody on the subway with paper towels that they had gotten at Target, and I'm like, man, these paper towels have gone on a journey across lots of subway stops and from the Target doors through lots of other doors to get to your condo, apartment, whatever, you know, and I just was like, I don't know if I can do it anymore. But, you know, city living is for some people, and that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a romantic aspect of it that I could get into. I'm so full of like paradoxes. Like part of me feels like I would love to like live in the country and like have my Walden moment and write poetry and chop firewood. But then like part of me knows that like I would never, like I would lose my mind and would want to be in a city. And then part of me is like, I could live downtown. I could be hip and have a little studio apartment and, you know,
check out the walk
buy my groceries
store.
at the bodega and sit in the park. And then I'd be like, nah, this is too, you know, I don't know. My fear is that I'm actually just a suburban person and I am just like built for the suburbs.
Here's what I think it is. I think just a driveway is nice. Having a place to, you know, pull your car in. Although, you know, the pushback could be that in city life, you don't need a car, which is fair. So anyway,
I would love to not have to have a car. Like if we design cities different, I mean, like, it's just very few places can you not have a car and have it be sustainable. You definitely can't at Denver. Like we are like our city is not, our public transit is not up to it.
Yeah. Let's get into it.
This is not
it.
Normal podcast content.
this is just Cortland and I catching up, you know, it's been a bit. So we always said we would never just record us hanging out and just hanging out. That.
It's unintentional though. It's not like we actually think that you and I pontificating about our future urban living situations is actually interesting content. It just happens to be part of the podcast. Maybe we'll cut it out. Probably we won't. This is just what you get.
There you go.
We have an interesting guest today to make up for it.
Yes,
so it'll be great.
A great guest. And also I do want to, there is something I want to talk about that's been happening on Twitter. And it's something that I'm going to say we've talked about on the podcast. We'll probably talk about it again, but, did you see that graphic of, don't bully your children about transphobia?
Yes, it was like the person like cutting the wings, the gay wings off of
children.
It was like, they were like rainbow wings and they're off. Was it a children? I kind of saw it at a glance and it was like mildly infuriating. So I kind of scrolled past it quickly.
Well, the infuriating
part, but I understand.
Was,
I get the reference.
Yeah. And somebody shared it and was like, and I'm going to give a content warning for the transphobia, but, and said like a more appropriate image would be if the parents were queer and they were actually cutting the genitals of these children. And it was like, so I because that large account shared that, it was somebody, Dwight, that's been in our Clubhouse spaces and our Twitter spaces, that shared the original image. And it just opened the door to all of the hate. And I had shared it just to say, like, if you're wondering if trans folks are being targeted right now, go read these comments, because the things that are being said right now are so awful. And I'm not here and bringing this up because I want to like perseverate on the awful things that are being said. But what I'm trying to say is I don't think people that aren't in the realm of having like it, people that are in communities that have trans people in their lives, that are in your social circles, I don't know if people realize just the level of transphobia that's happening and the things that are being said that aren't simply, you know, not that this is okay, but it's not just like, oh, I don't like trans people or that's not for me. It is very explicit and very targeted and very cruel. And I want to bring it up again because we had Transvangelical on the podcast and it, And she highlighted, you know, there's not enough trans people to fight this. Like, we need allies. We need advocacy. But I want to continue to spread that message that if you're not paying attention, if you think this doesn't impact you, it does impact you. And it impacts all our community and it impacts everyone around us. And I wanted to mention it. I don't know. Do you have thoughts to add?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not to spoil, we have an interview with our friend Celeste. She sat down and hung out with us. That'll be coming out at some point. And she mentioned, I think, either a survey or some piece of data where it was like, you know, this percentage, a large chunk of Americans who like don't have a single trans friend or person in their life or someone that they know on a personal level. And I think that that's a really, like, when these are not people in your life and they're just a talking point for politicians. And, you know, it makes it even easier for these folks who are perpetuating these really violent, harmful, toxic narratives about trans folks, about queer folks in general, in a way that makes it easier for people to dehumanize them in their mind and other them and not think about the reality of these being people, real people, the same way that, you know, we other and separate ourselves from the events that are going on in the Middle East. And we don't, you know, realize that like this is, you know, these are not clips on a movie. This is not, you know, something that's happening somewhere else. These are real people that are being affected.
Well, and can I also just say that how infuriating it is when people think that when you say cishet, that's a slur. And I was explaining that to someone today on Twitter. They were like, I what does that even mean? That's a slur to me. And I pulled up what comes up on Google and I'm like, Google's right there. Like you can just look at it and see that I'm just using a shorthand way to describe a cisgender person that identifies with the gender assigned at birth and also a heterosexual person. And that's not a slur. I'm just, you know, saying that. And they were like, that's your queer theory. That's your religion. I don't buy into that. And it's just so interesting that people can't even agree on vocabulary. Like, it's just like something mm-hmm. as simple as a vocabulary word has now become controversial. And let alone the humans that are part of this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's foundational to this anti-trans, anti-queer ideology. And, you know, Trans Angelical, she said it really great in that conversation that we had. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen. It's everything that's non-normative. Folks who relate to these normative realities. I mean, it would be like as if somebody saying, you know, well, we can reference Black folks as Black, but to reference me as white would be a slur, right? It's because if I think whiteness is the normative, if I think straightness is the normative, if I think that cisness is the correct way, the normal way, and these other things are corruptions, they are, you know, they are degradations, they are less than human, they are less than natural, less than valid. Again, these are all bases, providing a basis for how to dehumanize and other entire people groups, right? You know, we've seen this with the rampant Islamophobia that's going on, right? Like, you know, if Islam is the other, right? Christianity is the normative, white is the normative. So Middle Eastern, Muslim, these things are the anti of everything that people identify with. And when you begin to say like, oh, actually in the scheme of things, you are other to somebody, right? You as a straight person are other to us as queer people. And when, you know, as we begin to look at the data, you start to go like, oh, actually there's statistically probably huge numbers of bisexual folks, on top of the already known, you know, 18 to 20% homosexual folks who identify as that way. I mean, I've seen numbers upwards of like 60% of the population fall somewhere in that scale, right? That's the majority at this point. Gay Jesus, who's on TikTok, he just did a video about this. And he was like, you know, there's so much social stigma. Everyone that is now starting to go like, oh, I can identify as bisexual, even though I may be in a, you know, heterosexual relationship, or, you know, I may not be actively pursuing a same-sex partner. It's making it the reality. And that's what these people are afraid of, right? Like that is the great replacement theory. That is the idea that Christians are going to be replaced, that white people are going to be replaced by non-white people, that straight people are going to be replaced by queer people, that cis people are going to, and so we have to hold the line and stand firm and not give any ground and create this war mentality to defend and stand up for white, Christian, straight, values. And that is how you get Nazis.
And well, and on top of that, I think there's people that are like, if somebody's queer, something went wrong with the parenting. That was chatter that was on Twitter, like, oh, we need to triple down on the parenting and the control. And it's just such the opposite of what that image was trying to convey, right? Of like somebody being able to flourish and soar in their full selves, in their full identity, and yet telling people that parents need to triple down on an ability to be queer, to be able to come out. And there's what I think is missing in this whole conversation is the damage that is going to happen to children that have this heteronormativity forced down their throats. And based on the fear, we're going to come out with the same cycle of conversion therapy and the trauma of purity culture and religious trauma that's been happening all along that we're trying to combat. So, yeah, it's not parenting. People are queer. We exist. are trans. We have such incredible, incredible humans that we're friends with that are trans. And I'm so tired of the shit narrative that queer folks are pedophiles or trans folks are pedophiles, when it's really like these, I'm sorry, these fundamentalists need to look in the fucking mirror, because the pedophiles are not queer folks. The pedophiles that we're seeing are the people that are going into religious institutions and using that as a mask for abuse that they want to be able to get away with. Like, I just can't, I'm done with that narrative.
It's absolutely infuriating. And it's hard for me to even talk about, because I feel like if I say what I really think and feel, it's going to get, like, not that I'm anybody that people would cut clips up of, but like it could get cut up. It could be said out of context, but like this entire, like violent rhetoric about pedophiles is almost always queer phobia. Like almost always, like there is this, because we can all universally agree that harming a child is just beyond evil, right? Like everyone in the world is like,
right,
in general, can get on the same page. And so this idea is to perpetuate this violence around, I mean, I've seen people wearing shirts, kill your local pedophile, hang your local pedophile. It's cheered for and championed, and everyone, it is almost always a dog whistle for queer phobia, for violence towards queer folks. Because the reality is straight male culture is pedophilic. Like straight male culture idealizes barely 18, nubile. You just go watch any porn site that you want to see. It is barely legal, stepdaughter. Straight culture loves the idea of sexualizing children. So this is not a queer thing, right? And the people who are loud and violent about string up your local pedophile, they're only that way in order to perpetuate violence towards queer people. In almost all cases, because there is actually no accountability held for straight men perpetuating that type of abuse, right? And that's the whole idea of trans people in the bathroom. It's not about trans people. This is about it's not about protecting bathrooms, I guess is what I'm saying. It is about trans people. It is about wanting to perpetuate violence against the other, and not about protecting women, protecting girls, guarding against abusers. We just know that that's not true. That's not the case. That's not the end game for the people who are perpetuating these narratives. I don't know how all that's going to come out in the recording, but it does. It pisses me off too, like significantly.
Yeah. Well, I think we had some things we needed to get out.
I guess so. we said we were going to keep it short, though, and we have an incredible guest.
Yeah. All that being said, let's intro Sarah. Sarah is delightful. She wrote a book called The Exvangelicals. I'm so glad we got to talk to her about it.
But yeah, I'm excited to get into it. We had Sarah scheduled for a long time. It was really delightful to finally get to sit down and to be able to get this episode out when her book has just come out is exciting as well.
Well, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Welcome back to another episode of the Thereafter Podcast.
Yeah, we're so excited.
We have a guest with us today.
Hello.
Welcome, Sarah, to the show. We're so excited to have you here.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Sarah, just to kick us off, we would love for you to just kind of introduce yourself to our audience, to our listeners, and just kind of tell us a little bit about what you do, what you cover, and you have a book coming out. I've read most of it. And so if you want to, like, just as you do that, kind of talk about how that journey of writing that book came about, and we'll kind of wander from there.
Sure. So I'm Sarah McCammon. My day job is a national political correspondent for NPR. I have been in journalism, mostly in public radio, for 20 plus years now. I'm old, and most of that has been in public radio. I grew up evangelical in the 80s and 90s in the Midwest, and kind of, we can get into this more, but, you know, in a, I think, very sort of painful and from my point of view, thoughtful way. It did not feel careless at all or like something I took lightly. I did walk away from it to one degree or another in my 20s. There were just a lot of things, a lot of sources of cognitive dissonance, a lot of things that didn't feel right to me. And, you know, have really since then been in my early 40s now. So have been kind of trying to make sense of the world, like I think a lot of us are. The part where this book comes along is I had built a career in journalism, in, you know, what we would call secular journalism, nothing religious for a long time. And I had spent a lot of my early years of my career in some ways trying to distance myself from my evangelical background. I'd gone to an evangelical college and evangelical, you know, to kind of almost to the fundamentalist end of the spectrum Christian school. Felt like there were a lot of gaps in my education and also some things that I wasn't super proud of that I didn't necessarily want to talk about in the workplace. And, you know, so I had kind of left that behind, at least professionally, until 2015, 16, when I get assigned to not only cover the presidential campaign, but the Republican primary and eventually Donald Trump. And suddenly the thing everybody's thinking about, writing about, talking about is the movement that shaped me, that I came from. And I am seeing people and themes and ideas that I grew up just entrenched in, sort of as the focal point of some of the biggest tensions in our culture and in our politics. And so out of that, I started thinking about what I might want to say about it. And I started seeing a lot of people like yourselves, I think, on podcasts and social media and different sort of public spaces, wrestling with some of these same themes in really public ways that I hadn't seen before. And it seemed to me like something really interesting was happening, kind of felt like a movement and a coming together of a sort of a lot of different trends that felt like there was something to say. And so, you know, both as a person who had come from that world and as a journalist who likes to tell stories, I felt like the time was right. So the book I've written is called The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's part my story and part lots of other people's stories.
Yeah, that it's interesting. I guess I would love to ask, and this gets into kind of your personal story just a little bit, but that's part of your book. So that's there too. But one of the things that I was curious about, because you talked about going to DC on an internship while you were going to a Christian school and just the kind of real world experience. And I had something similar where I was at a Christian college. I almost became a missionary. I was immersed in that Christian bubble. And then instead I became a teacher and had like my foot in both worlds, right? Like you kind of feel like, oh, I have this like job that I go to that's quote unquote secular. And then I, you know, try to integrate that. And I'm curious, like, when you first started your career in journalism, was it that like, oh, I'm torn between these two worlds. I have this kind of secular career, but yet I still have these tenets of faith that I'm trying to hold on to. And like, how did that shift kind of while, was that kind of mostly because you're in, you know, you were so immersed, or did the secular world grab you? Did you fall? Is that what happened?
In short, no, I don't think the secular world grabbed me. I think a couple of things happened. I mean, first, when I started working, entering the working world was my first time to really be fully immersed in a secular environment, because I had gone to Christian school and Christian college, and that was pretty much my whole universe. With the exception of a relationship with my grandfather, who is a central character in this book, who was not a Christian, who was the person who really kind of was the target of all of our prayers growing up, and a lot of fears and worries on my part because of what I was being told about him. So he was kind of the contrast or the foil for this evangelical bubble I was existing within. So I knew there was something else out there, but I had been warned about it, told to pray about it, pray for it, you know, and don't ever become that. So when I did start my first journalism job or two, it was a new experience. But I also I really wanted to be in mainstream journalism. I loved writing. I loved talking to people. I was always kind of verbal and interested in reading and communicating. And I think, you know, in retrospect, something I write about in the book is that being in a space where questions were encouraged and were actually part of the, you know, a feature, not a bug, that was really exciting to me. Like, it was kind of empowering and exhilarating to know that I was not only allowed to ask questions and consider multiple points of view, I was supposed to. It was like an ethical obligation of my job. And I had grown up, you know, being surrounded, I describe this parallel universe almost of just the evangelical sort of intellectual infrastructure, right, of books and textbooks and magazines and movies and radio stations and TV stations and anything you could think of that the world, quote unquote, would have. Evangelicals had an answer for it and a version of it that was designed to, you know, they would say help you maintain your faith or grow in your walk with Christ, but also for children, help sort of protect you and shelter you from the world. And so I felt, and I talk about this a lot in the book, but there were just all these points of cognitive dissonance and a sense that something wasn't quite right in various ways. And being in a space where I was encouraged to ask questions was just so freeing. So I know that something was already happening in me and had been for a long time. And in journalism kind of felt like a safe place to exist in that uncertainty and that ambiguity. And that's one of the things I still love about my work is, you know, there are different philosophies about what journalism should be and plenty of opinions about how well the media do it. And, you know, the media is hundreds, thousands of different people and different organizations. But I'm still really drawn to the idea of at least trying, you know, not to necessarily be totally objective and have no opinion, but to get it right and be fair and try to understand even the perspectives you don't agree with. Like, I think that's fascinating and I think it's really important. So I don't know if that's really answering your question, but like, you know, I always knew the world was out there. So it's not like it sucked me in. But I felt, you know, almost like a calling to be working in a space that was not about starting with a foregone conclusion and promoting it to everybody that I knew. That was more about like just trying to kind of listen, take things in, assess, analyze. And so that's, you know, that's what I do. I hope that's what I try to do.
Your experience growing up in evangelicalism and its position as a culture in relation to politics and power versus your position reporting in politics and the way that evangelicalism is viewed kind of as a voter base or as a demographic by those in the political sphere. Do you feel like there has been a shift, or do you think, and or is there a different way that you view the relationship between evangelical culture and political power?
So growing up, I don't think I fully, I mean, I knew that we meaning my parents, my church, my teachers, my school, the organizations we were involved in and part of, I knew that we had views about politics, right? And the way that the world should be. Most people I knew were opposed to abortion in virtually all circumstances, maybe a few small exceptions. Most people I knew were opposed to same-sex marriage. You know, the issues in the 80s and 90s were a bit different than they are today. There were still some debates about evolution in schools, and I'm sure there are still some, but that would seem like it was a bigger issue then. Not that it affected me because I went to Christian school, but it was still something that our community was concerned about. And so there were, you know, there were sort of, I guess what I would have thought of or would have been conceived of as Christian answers to these things, right? No real discussion of progressive Christian perspective, but what we thought was sort of the Christian perspective on whatever the issue of the day was. And I remember hearing, like in 1996, when I was 15, when Bob Dole was the Republican nominee, there was a lot of frustration on the part of, very vocal frustration on the part of James Dobson of Focus on the Family, you know, one of the most prominent evangelical leaders then and to some extent still today. He made a big point of complaining that the Republican Party essentially hadn't prioritized abortion enough in its choice of, I think, a vice presidential pick and so forth. And I write about this in the book. And I remember that dust up, and I remember threats by people like Dobson to leave the Republican Party. I didn't realize, though, that evangelicals were such an important voting bloc, or that they were really even, that we were called that. I guess I'd heard the word evangelical, but it wasn't a word that I ever used or we ever used to describe ourselves. It was more a word that I heard, like when I went off to an evangelical college and sat in Bible classes and we talked about different traditions within Christianity for like the first time ever, really. I mean, this is sort of a side note, but the only notion I had of the history of Christianity or the many, many divisions within it was this idea that, you know, there had been this Reformation in 1517 when Martin Luther came and sort of enlightened everyone. And, you know, we didn't talk about the fact that the church had existed for like 3/4 of its current history prior to the Reformation, or how like the Bible had come together. None of that, like how the sausage was made stuff. So, you know, I didn't, much less did I have any idea that I was part of a particular social, political, cultural movement called evangelicalism. But, you know, as I got older, I kind of realized that's what we're called. That's what this is. It's a subsect of Christianity. Kind of gradually got to realize, well, maybe it's not the only way to be Christian, for one thing. And so I think my understanding of that label and its overlay with political and cultural ideas certainly evolved as I got older. And then, you know, I find myself in my 30s at the time, suddenly, like I said, covering evangelical politics in a really intense way. And I mean, I think the thing that has shifted in my lifetime, and this is not an original idea to me, but is really one that I agree with and that I've derived from my research and people I've interviewed who are smarter than me, is I think what's happened is that evangelicalism, certainly throughout my childhood, it was a political movement, but it had a strongly political dimension, but that has become front and center today in a way I don't think it, I think it was on its way then. I don't think it was fully there then.
Hmm. Yes. And I'm curious, because you write about the difference between the response to kind of Bill Clinton and his, you know, him and Monica Lewinsky versus kind of the response to Trump and some of the things that it you talk about a little bit about the hypocrisy. And what I see happening is, you know, and Kristen Coby's DeMay writes about this in Jesus and John Wayne, but like there's this force that's been building for decades, right? Where now it's coming to, wow, this is a very influential voter bloc, but also there's a lot of twisting the narrative to fit into this political box, this political agenda, and it's changed. The way that politics has been approached within that underneath that umbrella of evangelicalism has changed because of those, you know, what they were saying about Bill Clinton. They're able to twist those words now when they're responding to Donald Trump and the way that he interacts with women. I'm just curious your kind of perspective on that shift on, okay, well, if it benefits us, then we're going to have this perspective. If it benefits us to have a different perspective, okay, we'll kind of spin it then.
I mean, I think that's a human tendency. I don't think it's just an evangelical tendency, you know, toward groupthink or motivated reasoning. But I think you see it. I think you see it there. It seems to me that a lot of it comes down. I mean, I think about like my reaction to the 2016 trajectory. And I think I really, you know, I was really fascinated, like, what are evangelicals going to do? Because I remembered how intensely, I mean, it was a huge topic of conversation, Clinton's behavior. And I remember so many conversations and many of them sort of led by prominent evangelical leaders about like the importance of character. The character was like almost this buzzword. And you know, I document in the book a lot of the public statements that people like the Falwells and Dobson and others who, you know, are still around today in various iterations, the things that they said about Clinton and how basically this behavior was disqualifying. And yet, as we all know, it seemed like the metric was very different 20 plus years later for Donald Trump. And, you know, it's hard not to think that tribalism and ideology and whose team you're on or not on, that comes into that. You know, and I think that, and people like Kristen Cobus-Dumais have written about this very well, but there was a longstanding sort of sense among a lot of evangelicals that their group had been on top and sort of in power. I mean, just sort of the dominant culture for a long time, white Christians were the majority culture in America for so long. And then, you know, about the time that that starts changing because of the sexual revolution and increasing, you know, diversity and other changes, there's a sense of sort of erosion of that. And I think, you know, you see a slowly building movement toward increasing political power with an eye toward sort of preserving that cultural framework that had been sort of taken for granted, but is no longer. You know, the problem is, of course, that when you impose a religious framework on a, you know, on a country that is by design non-sectarian, with separation of church and state, that starts to get very messy very fast. And so, you know, I think that's some of what we're seeing today. But Trump was useful to, you know, I don't think he made any. He made much of an attempt to make people think that he was some kind of sincere evangelical. I mean, most of the time, I think it was pretty obvious he wasn't, but he made it very clear to evangelical leaders that he would deliver on their objectives. And that, I think, became supreme.
Yeah. And I wonder in the aftermath of that, what that has shifted within the kind of like deep mind of evangelicalism as a whole, in terms of this quiet part being said out loud. Because, you know, growing up in the evangelicalism that I grew up in, similar to, you know, what you're explaining, and in that time period, I never heard people talking about Christian education institutions as a response to desegregation, right? And integration of schools. And now I'm like, oh, this was very clear. Like, there was this big movement to like establish Christian institutions for schools so that, you know, we could have white schools still and have a religious exemption for that. That never felt like that was said out loud. And now I feel like it's not only being said out loud, but there is almost an emboldening of that culture to go, it's worth it's worth it. Look, I mean, yeah, Trump is, I have evangelical friends who are like, Trump is sleazy, but he got the justices, you know, he got us what he said he was going to do. And this, like, the ends justify the means. Has that shifted? Do you feel like that has shifted evangelical culture as a whole? And what is your, you know, obviously that's a huge question, but like, be curious what your perspective from where you're reporting is in, you know, a post-Trump, hopefully a post-Trump for a long time presidency, but like, you know, in where we're at now politically.
I mean, I'm not enmeshed in evangelical culture anymore, but I think from what I've read and observed, you know, I think it's hard to say. I mean, it's such a large movement. I hesitate to characterize it too broadly in that regard. But, you know, from the people that I talked to for my book, there was a sense that from some of them that their churches had moved in a direction they didn't really understand, you know, that either people in their lives, I interviewed some people who had people close to them who sort of had started out maybe believing in fairly standard evangelical or maybe charismatic ideas, demons and things like that, and moved kind of gradually. And then one person interviewed talked about a family member, you know, just moving toward conspiracy theorist thinking. Or, you know, some of the people I talked to kind of watched their churches seem, in at least in their minds, to kind of shrug at the George Floyd death, the death, the killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis. And, you know, I think for a lot of the people that I've spoken to, there's just like a sense of incongruity that either the movement has shifted and become more extreme in a way that they don't recognize or feel comfortable with, or it's just failed to respond to the moments, multiple moments, whether that's the rise of Donald Trump, whether that's racial injustice, even the pandemic. You know, I think a lot of churches saw division over how to deal with the pandemic. And that was a tricky thing to figure out how to deal with, right? We were figuring out in real time. And I certainly don't envy the role that public health officials had to play in making those kind of in the moment assessments or other leaders. I mean, even church leaders, I'm sure it was difficult to decide, like, how long do we mask and how long do we stay home and how much do we distance? Like, those are all challenging decisions, and they, you know, in a moment that I think we're in, where so many things that feel like they should sort of be ordinary and mundane, like do you wear a mask or not, suddenly becomes overlaid with politics and ideology and all this sort of larger significance. Those kinds of things become harder and more fraught, and so, I'm speculating here, but what it seems to me that what's happening kind of to the culture as a whole is happening in churches too, you know, this kind of deepening division around really ideological symbols. And I don't necessarily know what caused it or how we stop it, assuming that we do want to stop it, which I think probably we do. But it seems to be a feature of kind of this moment in our culture.
I mean, I was thinking about that too, because I'm curious your perspective as somebody who's done this work for 20 years now, because it used to be, hey, there's two things we really don't talk about, and that's religion and politics, right? And now, not only is everybody talking about it, but if you disagree, it's breaking your relationship, you know? And so it's breaking up families, it's breaking up. I mean, I've had people say, like, to me, I feel like, you know, you're just being too political. Or when I came out, it was like, I feel like you've just been influenced by your queer friends. Like, things, and it's just so wild how divisive it has been. And I'm just curious, like, is that Trump? Is that COVID? Is that, like,
what's the... Can you tell us, Sarah? What did it?
What was the one single explanation for everything that's happened?
This is going to be a popular episode.
I just want your perspective, because I feel like we all sit around and talk about this, and I'm just curious, like, when you sit around and talk about this, what do you think about this?
I don't think that it's all Trump. I mean, I think Trump is a symptom of something larger. You know, I don't think that Trump could have waltzed onto the scene without there being sort of an underlying appetite for something like that. Now, what led to that appetite? I mean, maybe ask a sociologist. Like, I do think that the internet has some role to play, right? I mean, Trump came to prominence, and I'm just using him as an example, not as the cause, to be clear. But he came to prominence in part because of Twitter, right? And his penchant for tweeting and sort of getting his message out there in really sort of noticeable ways. And I think this characteristic of technology, our technology today, and it's primarily the social media, but not just social media. I think it's dangerous, and it's not just a problem on the right. I mean, I think that people on the left should also be mindful of, as I was saying earlier, like the human tendency toward groupthink and toward, I mean, I think something that we saw probably all of us growing up is that the tendency toward really rigid orthodoxies, like these ideas that you cannot violate if you want to be part of the group. And certainly there should be some things that you can't violate. I mean, there should be some sacred principles, like, you know, racism is not okay. Homophobia is not okay. But I think sometimes there is a tendency, especially online, to just have these kind of, you know, these really, I mean, this is not a novel observation, but these really reductive conversations. And I think that's unquestionably a part of what we're dealing with today. Cause like the rhetoric that moves around so quickly and that kind of hardens so quickly online seeps into, I think, the way people talk to each other. And I love what I do in large part because so much of it is about talking to people face to face. And when you're sitting down face to face and hearing someone's tone of voice and watching their facial expressions and their body language, you learn so much about them. And, you know, maybe they say something that makes you a little uncomfortable, but you can tell they're uncomfortable too, and they're wrestling with it. Like, I'm much more sympathetic to somebody who is wrestling with an idea than asserting loudly, confidently an idea, even if it's a sort of harmful one. It's like, I want to know that you have some empathy and some compassion and some struggle, you know, and the internet makes that like almost impossible. And so I have to use it for work, but I am constantly telling myself that I need to use it less because it's bad. It's not all bad, but there's a lot of bad about it.
Yeah. So kind of back to the title of your book and this phenomenon of, you know, ex-evangelicals, I, you know, hadn't really been well aware of being evangelical or really knowing that word. And I definitely didn't, growing up in the church, know about people who had left or deconverted. I had heard of people who had converted to Christianity from atheism or Islam or something else, but I never heard stories of people who had left Christianity or left the church to become Catholic or some other tradition. And so I'm curious about your take on the phenomenon of ex-evangelicals and people who have deconverted or left their faith or changed their faith dramatically, and what's brought that about, and what that phenomenon, you know, like why that's happening.
So like you, and I did touch on this earlier, but evangelical is a label that I think has been useful for, you know, sociologists and demographers and pollsters, and maybe not one that most evangelicals call themselves. Although I think that may have changed somewhat in more recent years as it's become a more common term in the media, and it's carried other connotations. But I mean, growing up, we just called ourselves Christians. And I think we thought that our version of Christianity was the right one, to put it pretty simply. Like, we were definitely skeptical of like groups like Mormonism and even Catholicism and even to some extent mainline Protestantism.
Same.
Saw each of those movements as having certain flaws. Yeah. And you know, the emphasis was on really believing in Jesus and being saved and spreading that message to other people. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the label evangelical is one I kind of realized applied to us later. And I mean, I came across the term, and I talk about this in the book, the term ex-evangelical in the course of some of my reporting on the evangelical movement and Donald Trump. I was interviewing some women who were struggling with their evangelical identity and the movement's embrace of Trump, especially in light of the Access Hollywood episode. And someone mentioned that, you know, some people are kind of using the term ex-evangelical to describe themselves. And I that really caught my ear, because it seems like, you know, in the same way that evangelical is this very loose term, you kind of know what it means, but it's kind of, it applies generally to conservative Protestants in a particular subculture. It seemed to me like ex-evangelical describes something too. And it sort of points for me to the idea that if you come from evangelical culture, that means something specific. And, you know, there are different manifestations of it, different specific, you know, strains of theology, but there is kind of a unifying culture. I mean, there's, especially if you grew up in the 80s or 90s or early 2000s, you know, last 30, 40 years, there's, you know, certain types of entertainment, certain words, there's this idea of purity culture, which was so influential for millennial evangelicals and beyond. And this, there's just this whole sort of subculture and set of ideas that come with it. And to step away from that means stepping away from a specific community in a lot of ways. And, you know, when I was going through the process that people now call deconstruction of just trying to figure out what I believed and make sense of things and try to figure out the things that didn't seem to add up, there was no word for that. There was no online community for it. But I think a couple of things have happened in more recent years. One is absolutely the internet, for all of its downsides. It's also made it much easier to find people like yourself and connect with people. And so, you know, at one time, if you left a church, you might be gossiped about, whispered about, sort of shunned. Maybe there would be an intervention. But ultimately, if you decided to move on, you might really be estranged from people that had once been close to you. Today, that's still maybe true, but it's also true that you can, you know, that there are huge, there are hashtags with huge followings, you know, like ex-evangelical and deconstruction and others on TikTok or Instagram or Twitter, and people find each other and they're having these conversations around a lot of different themes, whether it is science or politics or queer sexuality or purity culture or any number of other aspects of the evangelical subculture that people have struggled with and that may have prompted them to leave or reconsider some aspect of their faith. But I don't think ex-evangelical says anything really about what you are now. It just says that you have evolved away from that world. And, but you know, what I was seeing as I was kind of observing, intentionally observing some of these online spaces, including, you know, Facebook groups and so forth, is that wherever people landed, the experience of leaving that seemed to have, there seemed to be a real commonality, and people were kind of gathering and talking around these kinds of themes. And I resonated with a lot of them. And so I wanted to write about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize it was something that I needed until I found it. And I think that it's becoming more common for people to leave church and directly find a podcast like ours or a community or, you know, like just like in step, like right away. I mean, I spent 5 years, you know, kind of sitting on my couch, smoking weed, going, what the fuck was that? Before I like found other people who also had that experience. And it wasn't something that I really thought that I needed. I was so happy to be out of that culture. And then to meet someone who also knows who Bob the Tomato is. And you're like, oh, you have a piece of identity that I don't know if I've been able to talk to anybody about this before.
Or if recently. You're a little older, it might be like Patch the Pirate or Salty the Singing Songbook. Oh, yeah. I don't know if those resonate for anybody. Oh, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. The Donut Man. Yeah, it is interesting. So I'm curious of your personal experience of like, did you have a moment of kind of reconnection with earlier aspects of yourself and aspects of this culture you grew up in after pretty functionally living kind of outside of that and in, like you said, more of a secular job and environment. What was it like for you to kind of, to be of the world?
In the world.
to come back and kind of re-explore and think about these things? Had it been a while for you since you had thought about some of these things or remembered some of these things from your past?
Yes and no. Like I actually don't think that any of this ever is really that far away from me. And I don't know, maybe that's different from some people, but as much as I might have existed in the outside world for a long time, I still think about, I think about aspects of my evangelical background, you know, every day, many times a day. Some of them are good and some of them are not, from my perspective. But I think, I mean, certainly writing this book was an opportunity to re-explore those things in a deeper way. I went back and I dug up some of my old journals and my old letters and even ordered a bunch of books and textbooks online that I had had around my home or my school when I was younger. And some of them I was kind of shocked to see, you know, just how, for example, some of the textbooks we had in Christian school from like Bob Jones University or Pensacola Christian, you know, how they talked about race or slavery or gender for sure. You know, and it's probably what you would expect, but it very traditional patriarchal roles in some cases, what seemed to me like a minimization of, not just seemed like, I mean, some of the passages I quote in the book are absolutely a minimization of slavery. Not a denial that it existed, but a real failure to really reckon with it. And it was kind of, I knew that, but it was kind of stark for me to read it again all these years later and be like, wow, this is what I was shaped by. And, you know, to kind of reflect on like, wow, I mean, I always knew there were gaps, but to sort of see them up close again was a little bit, humbling and disconcerting. And you know, then there were also some moments that were really, I think, kind of sweet. Like I write in this book pretty honestly about my family and some of it's difficult. But I also like, I share a letter that my mom wrote me after like my first romantic heartbreak. And while it is steeped in the language of purity culture, I think it also was very sweet and kind and it showed a lot of compassion for me, you know, coming from my mom and the way that she could provide it. I think I came away from the experience of writing the book, you know, both pretty confident in my sense that this wasn't a world I wanted to live in anymore, but also, you know, appreciating some of the things about it that shaped me for better or for worse.
Yeah, I hear that. And I, what I love about your writing too, is that you bring in your story, but then you also explain everything as you're kind of documenting the movement and the history. And, you know, I know sometimes we'll have listeners on our podcast that aren't necessarily ex-evangelical. And so we'll use terms and terminology and language that they're not familiar with. And so you're also kind of bringing in all of that context and that all of the pieces that pull that together. But I know we're kind of getting close to time. One question that I do want to ask though, because you talk about this a little bit in the book, but one thing you talk about is the shifting role of the media and the perspective of the media, because when you started, it was very different than when you were on the Trump campaign and probably up till now. And so I'm just curious if you can speak to that. And there's been some censorship on social media platforms. There's been a lot happening, especially on Twitter, I know. And so I'm curious if you can just speak a little bit to that landscape.
I mean, I think criticism of the media is nothing new, and it's there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I think most politicians that I've covered have criticized the press to some extent, and that's perfectly within their rights. And I probably would too if I were in their shoes. But I think what I saw when I covered the Trump campaign was an intensity and a rancor around it that I hadn't seen. And also the sort of the use of the press as kind of the butt of the joke, sort of a scapegoat. I talk about, I've talked about for years. People ask what, you know, what those Trump rallies are like. And, you know, it's always been a big theme of his rallies to sort of take a moment and point at the back of the room and call out the press and say how disgusting and evil those people in the back are. And, you know, it kind of feels like a joke, but it's actually, you know, it is concerning when you see things like the infamous t-shirt that someone wore to a, you know, a Trump rally just before the 2016 election that said "Rope Tree Journalist." You know, it was a sort of a suggestion that journalists should be killed. That's something that I think there was, and I hope will continue to be, a longstanding bipartisan across the ideological spectrum consensus that that's not something we do here in America. We have freedom of the press. You can say, you can criticize the press as much as you want, but it's a free public marketplace of ideas. We have liberal media, we have conservative media, we have everything in between. That's all fine. What's not fine is violence and inciting anger and hatred and yes, potential violence. So I hope that that temperature will be turned down. After January 6th, I worry even more about that kind of thing. Not just for journalists, but, you know, anyone in some of these roles that we rely on to protect our democratic institutions. You know, I and my colleagues have interviewed election officials, including Republican election officials, who've been threatened and berated and attacked for simply doing their jobs and trying to carry out free and fair elections. And that is something that should concern everyone and certainly should concern Christians, I think I can say.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I went to one Trump rally I was there reporting back to the DNC, because I was doing a lot of work with, not to the DNC, but to a Democratic group. I was there on opposition research, essentially. But it was terrifying. It was a very scary experience for me. And I can't imagine, I was just like somebody in the crowd. I can not imagine being in that context of like in a particular area being specifically pointed at and, you know, pointed out as the enemy in that space. And I mean, to your point, it's not just Trump, but it is, you know, that experience that you kind of talk about it's scary.
And, you know, and the thing that I say a lot is, or have said many times, is that the thing that I think, really gave me pause, and I haven't been to a Trump rally in a while, but I'm sure I will before long. The thing that gave me pause was the fact that people beforehand, you talk to them and they're very friendly and, normal. And then there's something about everybody looking up at a person on the stage who is, you know, saying these kinds of things and sort of riling up the crowd, and the temperature in the room changes. And, you know, I think that's something that a lot of us would probably recognize in a different way if we've been in church, right? The power of a charismatic figure at the front of the room who has won the trust and the confidence and the admiration of the people in the seats or in the rows. And, you know, I think whoever we are, whatever our ideological or religious perspective, it's important to maintain a certain healthy skepticism of that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what letters by their name. Mm.
I do have one more question, just kind of random. As you wrote your book, and you had a pretty good sense of the experience. You said you were in these Facebook groups, you resonated with the experience, you saw what people came out of. Were there any interviews that you did, or did you come across information that surprised you? And what was that?
That surprised me. Well, I think, and I don't want to get too specific for obvious reasons here, but I think there were some people I talked to that told me things they asked me not to put in the book or not to put their name to. And usually there were things that had to do with spouses or partners. Like there were some people who were not on the same page as their partner about certain things, aspects of their deconstruction or just issues related to sort of their identity. And, you know, I didn't put those in the book, but I think the thing that it didn't really surprise me, but I guess it highlighted for me is the fact that because these journeys are so personal and so individual and they happen at different paces and for different reasons and in different contexts, that can complicate all kinds of relationships, certainly relationships with family, but also relationships with partners. And I think we all know that, but it was kind of a reminder of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why some people don't deconstruct, or they put it off, even if they're feeling torn and conflicted. It's very scary to face those questions because there can be real emotional and social costs for facing them sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Did you know that?
No, I. It's just,
and all
it
the
is
divorced
a good reminder.
Bisexuals in the room said amen.
Anyway. I'm like a Kinsey 2 or 3. Does that count?
Yeah, yes, you're in.
Absolutely,
welcome
it
aboard.
Counts.
We regularly say we're not sure we believe in straight people anymore. So,
to my great regret, I really like men, but you know,
same. Girl, same.
Well, let's give you a chance to plug, you know, where people can find you, engage with your work. We always, always, always encourage people to pre-order. I know, but you're getting close to that release day. So where can people look you up, follow you, and order your book?
Yeah, release day is March 19th. And yeah, pre-orders help a lot. So if you're thinking about buying the book, please do. And please do it now. Because it's a huge boost for authors learning all these things about publishing I didn't know. But the book is called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's available through Macmillan. If you just Google it, it'll pop up at all the usual booksellers. I'm on Substack too. It's probably the best way to find me. Sarah McCammon, my Substack is called Off the Air, A Journalist's After Hours Thoughts. And I have information about the book there too.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Cool. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you are busy out here on the road reporting, doing your work, doing your writing, promoting the book. We're really grateful for you taking time and hanging out with us on the podcast today. And please go pre-order Sarah's book. It's really important. We say it here all the time. Pre-orders matter. I don't care that you can get the book in 2 days on Amazon Prime. If you're going to buy it now. And then it'll just be there and you don't even have to think about it. So yeah.
I will say, if I can say, there is an audiobook version as well, narrated by yours truly. So
yes.
That's also an option. I like audiobooks sometimes because I get distracted when I read.
That will be 1000% how I consume the book. Will be an audiobook while I am cleaning my house, probably. That's usually what I'm doing.
Awesome.
So yeah, you'll hang out with me while I do dishes relatively soon, and I'll be excited about it. So yeah, thank you for taking the time, and we're excited to follow along and all the things that you do next.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.
All right. That's a wrap. Another one.
Yeah. Go check out her book, The Ex-Evangelicals. It's available now. Order it, read it. It's good. I've read almost all of it now, and talking to her made me want to like go to journalism school. I was like, oh, this is pretty badass.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that way when there's a few people who I see doing incredible work. Brad Onishi, who I forget whether we referenced in that interview, or not. But you know, he's one of those people that I just see him doing this work and I'm like, fuck, that's such good, important work. And I get excited by the work that he's doing. I'm excited to see Sarah and the work that she's doing as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, where can people find you, Cortland, on all the socials?
Yeah, I'm all over the internet, at Cortland Coffee. I'm the only one, Coffey, Cortland, like Portland with a C. Instagram, I'm pretty active on, so you can hit me up there. Twitter, I can't get away from it. I'm still there. All the other places. Megan, where can people find and connect with you as well as the show?
I actually think you should start. You're a big enough name that you should say that your name is Cortland, like Portland. No, I'm getting it backwards. You should say The Portland is actually Cortland with a P. But people can find me at The Pursuing Life on Instagram, Twitter, all the places. Check out our Patreon, patreon.com/thereafterpod, and Instagram and all the things. So that's a wrap.
Absolutely. That's a wrap. Until next time, everybody, we will see you next week.